We can't talk about sports, first of all, or being Puerto Rican without mentioning that Benito is going to be headlining Super Bowl halftime this year. And I am so hyped. Y'all don't even know.
I can already see it. They're going to have to hate on the halftime performance in two languages.
Yes. And let me tell you something. They better get these closed captions right.
Yeah.
Because I know Benito, he's not going to be speaking English.
No.
Everybody better Duolingo it up. Yeah, I can't wait. Yo, I was so hyped. You have no idea. I'm going to be insufferable once again.
That's what we want. That's what we want.
I know, right? Seriously. Okay, here we go. I'm going to start off again with our question. I got two for y'all today. Okay. Currently, what, who, where is your third rail? Like, what's your live wire this week? Because I feel like a week goes by, but a year worth of news happens. So what is it this week?
Oh, man. For me, it's the flotilla that's taking place.
That's a good one.
And I think it's my live wire because it's not in the news here. And so you have a humanitarian flotilla, so boats that started in one place traveling to Gaza with humanitarian aid and supplies. These are citizens. This is not military. This is private people. As they're going, more and more boats are joining them. And it's so cool to see, but then they start getting attacked by drones. And what we're not hearing is what the other countries are doing. Italy has sent a war vessel to join them. Turkey is sending drones. Spain is sending a warcraft vessel to travel with them and protect them. And if I wasn't on TikTok, it's not even, I opened the AP news. I opened a BBC and I'm not seeing it. And this is the brink of a massive war. So that's my live wire this week.
That's a good one. My live wire might get me canceled, but I'm going to say it anyway. My live wire is Kamala Harris. She's on a book tour. She is being protested at some of her venues. And some people believe that she is beyond reproach, beyond protests, beyond public critique. And I hate to inform those people that no one should be. I believe people in power should be protested. They owe us. We are their constituents. We voted them in. We make them millionaires and billionaires, right? They have a responsibility to us. And I don't want to hear that she's a private citizen either. Just like I don't want to hear that Obama's a public citizen. Should Obama be being protested for what he did about immigration in this country during his tenure? Yes. And what he did with drones? Yes. All day, every day. As should every other politician. And she's not a private citizen because I do believe that this book is setting the stage and framework for her to run again. From the excerpts I've read, it doesn't seem as though she has grown, shifted, or evolved in terms of her stance on Gaza. And I get it. She had 107 days. I get it. She's a Black woman. I understand how the lens and the stage was completely different for her. And we have to take accountability for the mistakes that we make. We're smart people. She is a smart person. And I demand more of her. Did I vote for her? Yes. For our audience, don't come for me. I voted for her. I voted for her. I voted for her.
I remember those conversations leading up to that.
Yeah, I voted for her. And she's a person in power. She's not beyond reproach. So she should be being protested. She should be evolving on certain topics. And she should be taking some accountability for the results of the election.
I hear you. In support of all of my friends who have amazing kids with autism, my live wire is bad origin stories. Since last we met, there's a theory that acetaminophen, that Tylenol is a cause of autism. What happens when the monkeys run the circus? To all of my friends, to all the young people I know who have an amazing superpower and are rocking anywhere on the spectrum, I sincerely apologize to the buffoons in charge and apparently in health who have now suggested for the headache that they've become, that Tylenol as a cure has caused autism. So to all the laymen who are now medical experts, on behalf of many of us, please shut it.
Yeah, 1,000%. Wow, how crazy different those three live wires were. And that's why we are the Dynamic Trio, otherwise known as the Third Rail Podcast. So another take that I'm so curious to poke you all about, is there someone who, besides, you know, the obvious players in the government, who could take several seats this week on our train metaphor? Who can sit all the way down? Who is taking up either too much space or being just too loud and really wrong? We talked about it last episode, is how the mic is being passed to a lot of people without context, without expertise, without an idea of what they're talking about or what they're doing, leading companies and corporations. I think for me, it's the CEO of Starbucks who has decided to close 900 stores. And it's no accident, so let's not pretend that it is, that 10% of those stores are unionized. So he's targeting the stores that had the gall to organize for fair wages. Like, sit down. I don't want to hear you speak anymore. You are just loud and you're wrong. Even though your homegirl over here has been, boycotting Starbucks for a very long time. But still, those are people. Those are livelihoods that are at risk. And, I think the precision with which he's targeting these unionized stores is cruel. And so that's for me, who can have a seat.
I'll take one that, back to Melina's take, could get me canceled. In deeply loving Black women, I have to accept the responsibility as a Black man when I'm wrong or I say something crazy. There is a sister who's sounding crazy the more she speaks, at least for this week. Amanda Seales, please have a seat for the longest. This sister has been imploding from the inside. The only person I know that's mad at everybody is somebody who's deeply wrong about everything. Amanda Seales has been so toxic lately on her takes on everything that recently, by comparison, she's making Candace Owens make a lot of sense. Amanda, take a breath. Sis, we love you. Less is more. Amanda Seales, please at least take a seat for a 60-second timeout and recognize that being right is better than being loud. My mama used to warn me about folks who are strong and wrong because they think they're both and they're not. We'll take you back 7 days, but please, Amanda, take a timeout.
I haven't listened to any of her takes lately, so I'm curious to hear what got her on the list of folks that needed to take a seat.
When you're looking for both attention and you're trying to give direction, I've heard the adage, good meat makes its own gravy. But thirst trapping and truth telling are not the same thing.
I think it's safe to say, Melina and I know what our homework is this afternoon. I'm actually going to go in the opposite direction. I want to talk about who I want to put at the front of the train, and that's Cardi B. The joy and honesty and realness that she has brought. I think I've listened to every podcast episode. If you're familiar with Angie Martinez, longtime DJ, huge name in the music industry in New York City, she's got a podcast. Her and Cardi B talking. Cardi B on Who's Your Daddy podcast. Like, I've watched all of them, and I could not be more enamored with the real person telling real life stories, answering questions like, how are you going to raise your little boys to treat women? And just so educated in so many different areas. And as someone who lives in New England, had to have a talk with my wife yesterday that the Patriots got Cardi B and the Chiefs only got Taylor. But I think if people aren't listening to what she's doing and saying, diss tracks aside, because it was beautiful, that's someone our world could look to. So, yeah.
Oh my God, I love the direction you took that in. I love me some Cardi B, Bodega Maddie. Oh, yeah. I know, Ginny, you've been listening to the whole album, probably on repeat. Yes. Okay. That's what I thought. All right. Thank you for indulging me, y'all. I'm so excited to kind of talk through youth sports culture with the two of you. I think sports in general for the three of us is very important, either because we were all athletes in our heyday, either we're forced to coach or love to coach, whatever your bag is at the schools that we used to teach at. And I think we come at this through three, as usual, per usual, three different lenses. And I'm excited to kind of dive into NIL debates, you know, trans inclusion, women athletes, equal pay, accessibility to youth sports. So I just remember that as a kid, I felt like youth sports were the great kind of equalizer. It's where you met a lot of your friends, right? It's where you got all the energy out. It's where you learn about teamwork and skill and had a good time. But I think today it has morphed into, I think some of those things still exist. And I think it has morphed into something different because capitalism. But I think today it's about like access, identity, equity, shapes who gets to play. It shapes who gets paid and it shapes who gets left out. And for me, it's sad because I want everybody to play. As a former coach, as a former athlete, as a mom. So I'm interested to hear from you both about what has been the greatest like change over the course of the last 20 years with youth sports, whether it's an evolution or whether it's a rollback.
All right, let's go. As a former coach, I think that access to healthy and supportive training, physical training, has definitely improved. Right. Like from the culture of 90s athletics. Right. If it hurts, it's right. So there's actually some science behind how we train young people and how we train ourselves in general. The downside, I think, is that no one listens to it unless it's about improving performance. And I think that what I have seen change in the last 20 years is that so little of it has to do with sports anymore. Like private equity invested $40 billion into youth sports because it's a place to make money now. When I was coaching high school basketball, I despised the AAU because the number of coaches I saw, it was about them saying the player was successful, not actually the player. And this is such a complicated question for me because I want every young person to have the ability to be physically active, to do the individual sport and find out what that means to who they are, to do the team sport and learn the skills and understand that. But it's not about sports anymore. It's about winning. And it's about winning at all costs. And what we are sacrificing in order to say we won is our children. And the science, the economics, everything points to that direction. And yet we don't listen.
Deep cut, Jenny. It's definitely that paradigm of collaborating versus competing. And in what it does to the erosion of culture. I want to take on NIL as a necessary disruption to business as usual, because what we know is that business as usual is highly unusual. Take my inspiration from Warner Brothers cartoons, because that's where all great inspiration comes from. I remember learning from Bugs Bunny that it's no fun when the rabbit got the gun. NIL. Name, image, and likeness. Ultimately, the democratizing of capitalism and opportunity into the free market has become the op in the group chat, apparently. Except what it exposes is the expansion of economic opportunity. I'm an 80s baby. There were only two groups of folks that were white that came into the inner city in the 80s and 90s. One were drug dealers. Two were college athletic recruiters. And they were both coming for the same high. Before NIL, all the money was concentrated into boosters and private donors who would own the directions that young people, especially high school athletes with college aspirations, would go. They held the purse strings. They would say, not to all, but to many of those aspiring athletes with collegiate hopes who came from single parent homes, we'll get your mother out the ghetto. We'll get your mama a house. We'll get you that car that you wanted. In fact, they sounded a little bit like the drug dealers did they not? What NIL has done is open the market so that athletes with dignity can get the money in their pockets. And boy, is that making everyone mad. But why take me? Why take my word for it? Please, Third Rail family, enter Nevin Shapiro and the 2001 to 2010-11 Miami Hurricanes. There's a 30 for 30 on Netflix about the Miami Hurricanes in that 2001 to roughly 2010-2011 period. He was a major private booster and scam artist in the South Florida, Dade County, Miami community, who was lining the pockets of players and the institution, because it resulted in an NCAA self-imposed suspension before it was an NCAA sanction, all about putting money in players' pockets. Here's the paradigm shift that's related to youth sports. The power shift has gone back to students, many from underrepresented, underprivileged backgrounds, and their parents having control over their direction, as opposed to the powers that be having that power. And what an interesting time it is, racially speaking, when the way out of the ghetto is controlled by the people in the ghetto. The subtext is clear. Any economic engine that can't be controlled predominantly by a dominant race has to end. What fun when the rabbits got the gun. That is the root and problem of the NIL. There is now the root and fruit that not everyone can eat from. And as a dad of athletes who will be NIL athletes, I'm loving it.
Florence, I have a question for you, because I love this. And I think that what you're speaking to is that perfect disruption. My question for you is, capitalism does, supremacy does what it does, right? And so I'm wondering if you have thought of what we can keep an eye out for if the NIL is starting to be co-opted by those systems.
I think it's a great question. Any of my young people, certainly my children I talk to, who are at current aspiring athletes who may or may not go on to play sports in college or professionally, I'm encouraging them all to go to law school. Because if you're not going to be the athlete, you can be the athlete's agent. I think I hear Nicole Flynn. For those of you not in the know, shame on you. But she is principally the agent to Jalen Hurts, and by it so many more. She's a Delta who reached out to her fraternity brother as he was entering the league, Jalen Hurts, who's a brother of Omega Psi Phi. What up, bros? I can hear y'all now. But she became his agent, and by it, the agent of a lot of top flight NFL players. So, Jenny, to your question, if it's inevitable, then it may as well be immediate. If this is going to be a bull running in the market, boy, we got to learn how to make more matadors.
Interesting. Fascinating. Because I know nothing about the world of NIL. So thank you for that, Lawrence. I think mine is affordability. I think we've been kind of hinting at accessibility. And Lawrence and I joke about this, but it's kind of tragic at the same time how much we pay in dues, how much we pay in club fees, how much we pay in tournament fees. And all three of us on this screen are very privileged in that we are able to do that. I only have to do it for one, but Lawrence, you have to do it for several, depending on the season, and you probably have like some weird matrix somewhere. He probably is working just to pay dues and summer camp. For me, that's been the biggest change that I've seen in the past 20 years. When I played soccer, it was maybe, you know, 50, 100 bucks a season, and I played both town, city, travel, and I played club. It was not $5,000 a year, plus tournament fees, plus if you get on the elite team, and I'm specifically talking through a football/soccer lens, football as in the real soccer. Soccer for me is the big equalizer. The whole world plays it, and you just need a ball. in some countries, they don't even use a ball. They don't have a real field. Some of them don't even have shoes and they play. You need $5,000 plus tournament fees plus your own ball and spend $400 on uniforms. Make it make sense, people. I was recently watching an interview with A-Rod and someone asked him, what's the biggest difference in youth sports culture now? And he goes, if I was born in the 2020s, he goes, you would never know who A-Rod was because my single mom would never have been able to afford baseball club fees. How many A-Rods are all over the country in, you know, lower income places, in the hood, like that don't have access to these clubs that are just that, but are full of talent and the love of the game. I feel like even in the NBA, you see it. There aren't folks like LeBron that we see all the time coming from single parent homes or no little to any means. We have a whole bunch of nepotism in the NBA. You know, so-and-so had, a baby with a white woman in the 80s or 90s or early 2000s. And now the whole league looks like Drake's.
Well, here, hold these two in the worlds collide kind of tension, Melina. Here's what I will say to tip in. In a lot of these pay-for-play arenas, and all of us have been there either as coaches or as parents, in these pay-for-play arenas where the price ceiling is the gate kept, a lot of these kids are trash. Terrible. Horrible. Their parents pay to get the kids out of the house.
Correct.
The parents or the family members or the au pairs need something to do on Saturdays or on the weekends. They need business of their own because they have no business of their own. So they pay and the whole family's involved in a sport. Their kids are terrible. Pay for play doesn't mean ability to play. It just means that you pay for it. What if the pay for play culture and the NIL culture, which, by the way, is very soon creeping into high school. And I can't imagine it's unreasonable because I would do it if we're following the funnel to creep its way into recreation sports. What if the democratizing of the monetizing of sports as a gateway to professional sports made its way to some of those rec sports? And if I'm a corporation and I want to fund a high school team, a rec team, I'm not paying for those trash pandas whose parents are paying for them to play. I'm paying for the best and the most qualified. That is going to disrupt the pay for play model in that wealthy families can just get their kids to play. The more talented kids, as the ones you're describing, Melina, who have neither sock nor cleat nor goal, will have that. Boy, the neighborhood is going to change. And if I were reading those tea leaves, boy, I'd hate NIL too, because what are we going to do on Saturdays when we usually pay to send our kid away?
I'm going to be cheeky for a second. Is that DEI?
Could one imagine? And that illegal DEI, which is usually antithetical to the business model, is great for business.
Always.
So I'm thinking a lot about what you're saying, which I love. There's this great organization called Project Play. They're with the Aspen Institute, and they did tons of research on the state of play in the United States. And so much of what we're talking about is this getting to the next level and access, right? So they say that like 71% of high-income families pay for their children to play, whereas 31% of low-income families do. I think we can understand all of that. There's the nasty return on investment, that ROI, that I see happening with parents who spend all this money, then expecting those trash players, but I spent all this money. And like, they can't give up their own financial investment for their child's well-being. And so I think there's that piece. I also think that the dark side of all of this is that competition capitalism piece. So what we're saying is that every young person should have the opportunity to play. And those who are elite athletes should be able to move on to the next level, regardless of economic background. Tell me why we don't want trans kids to play. They're kids, right? I go back to this argument, right? Trans females will hurt other people in the sport. Science has found no competitive advantage prior to puberty between what is, using the binary, XX and XY, knowing that XX and XY are not the only determining factors. So if we want young people to be physically active, knowing that the rates of obesity have doubled since COVID in young people, we want all young people to be active and healthy, and we know the relationship between that and mental health. Why are we trying to lock these folks out? And the only thing I could think of is that you really don't want to lose. Like, you'd rather hurt a child than lose. And this is where that, like, winning piece is so worrisome to me, because we are barring entry. We are telling competitive athletes, right? We have people in the Olympics who are genetically born female, but then because their body creates more testosterone, they're being removed from competitive events. They're having things stripped from them, winning stripped from them. So what we're talking about has nothing to do with competition, and it has nothing to do with science. It has to do with misogyny and the control of winning and competition to be male-centric. And there is this false narrative about protecting women. You want to protect women, give us healthcare. Like, I'm good, right? And equal pay.
In sports.
In sports.
Access to reproductive health.
But yep.
Go on. Go off, Ginny.
Right. The Army and Air Force actually did a study on some of this, because prior to the ban on transgender folks, we had transgender military service people, and they take a yearly test. And they did not see a significant advantage. They saw them lose the ability to perform at a higher level. You don't keep it with hormone therapy. So this is just about power. And to me, everyone having access to this thing, because the gatekeeping is so deep in so many different ways.
Thank you so much for naming that, Ginny, and, you know, for calling it out, because there's so much debate. But trans athletes make up such a tiny portion of the athletic population. And so in that NCAA, I saw this at a congressional hearing, and we're having all of these debates. We're creating a boogeyman, another dog whistle, another segment of the population who are oppressed to be fearful about, to be scared about in the swimming pool or on the field. We've seen this play before. We've seen it with Black folks. Remember those super predators that the Clintons talked about? We have seen this type of fear mongering before. And to your point, who gets to decide whose bodies are welcome in sports?
And if you look at those trans athletes that have been denied the ability to compete or had awards taken away, they're often of African descent or from Africa. So there's a whole nother layer to this. Also, to your statistical question, Melina, it's less than 10 athletes out of 500,000 in the NCAA.
That is obnoxious that we are having these conversations over 10 people. Let those children live and have fun and compete and have access to all of the amazing things that all three of us know that sports do for kids and youth and college kids. And I know, though, that trans people in general only make up between 1 and 2% of the population of the United States of America. Have any of you ever played hurt when you were athletes?
Yeah, more than I should have. I at 44, I feel it every day. Fractured my right patella when I was 10. Fractured my right tibia when I was 15, in my sophomore year of high school. That was the one I think is relevant to maybe where you're going. I'm petulant, starting varsity football both ways. Fractured my patella at the beginning of week two. I'm sorry, my fractured my tibia the beginning of week two. Impetulant boy, 6 weeks in the cast. I got my cast off on a Tuesday. I was playing again that Saturday. I don't think I ever recovered since. So playing hurt as a bonehead. Yes, I've done that.
How about you, Ginny?
So funny, because I heard that question in two ways, and I'm wondering which one you were thinking of. The first is you pretended to be hurt, and the second is you played when you were hurt. And I think I played when I was hurt most of my career once I got into high school and into college. Like, I don't ever remember being totally healthy. I don't remember anyone being totally healthy. And I think that's why when we started, I said, I do think the training and the understanding and like rest and recovery. I'm out here looking like I'm still an athlete. Like, I got my e-stem, I got my cups to do my cupping. I got, and it's because I played through so much injury and pain for so long. So I think that part of it is interesting. When I heard it the other way, which is, have you ever played hurt, like pretended to be hurt? It brought me to think of the increasing number of young people who are dropping out of sports by age 12. And it has to do with specialization. It actually has to do with the money piece a lot. Like, they report feeling additional stress because of their family's investment. So that was the two ways I heard that.
I want to give a shout out to the healthcare industry and the evolution of concussion protocol, especially amongst kids. My son has a concussion. He's been out 2 weeks. And by out, I mean out. His pediatrician was like, no PE, no recess, and no contact sports, period. And I can appreciate that because I've played with concussions. Didn't we all? I got a concussion at a state tournament. I had a big black eye and I still played. I'm really happy, like, as a coach, as a parent, that that has come a long way and that it's kind of like unacceptable to just throw a kid out there and have them play with a concussion or concussed. I'm thinking about kids who pretend to be hurt because the love of the game for them isn't there. And maybe never was. The parent is living vicariously through the child. And I see it. I can identify it so quickly. And it breaks my heart that the parent either is willfully ignorant and sees it and doesn't care and pushes forward. You know, they just don't see it, which is even more heartbreaking because that implies that they don't know their children.
But their child is hurt and they're still making them play.
Oh, I've seen that a lot, too.
I tell you, on the psychological part of sports, I've had my own personal brush with it. Like many parents, you've been there, family members, rich aunties, etc. You've spent thousands of dollars for your young person to play rec sports, and one day they wake up and they don't want to play that sport no more. Now you're left with thousands of dollars worth of equipment that no one can use. Elijah got really good at baseball, started playing when he was 8, was an all-star by the time he was 12, and then decided he didn't want to play baseball anymore. An amazing center fielder, fastest kid on the team. They could just make him a pinch runner and he'd go take all the bases. I'm watching it. Never played it, but I'm watching it. Why don't you love baseball? Talked to a buddy of mine who played baseball at Columbia, and he gave me some really good insight. EJ was having trouble at the plate. If he was up for 3 at-bats during a game, he could go 1-for-3 or he could go 0-for-3. But in my head, I'm looking at the mathing math. Hey, dude, if you're 1-for-3, you know, that's about, you're batting over 3,000 in the MLB. That's a heck of a batting average. And then my buddy gave me some insight that was really helpful. He said, baseball is one of the worst sports in the world to feel like you're failing. And then I saw it different. When you're at the plate, you're at the plate by yourself. When you hit by yourself. But more importantly, when you strike out by yourself. And it was the strikeouts, not the hits where he got on base, not the awesome pop flies he was making, not the bases he was stealing, that started to erode his confidence and his mental health. Conversely, he's playing basketball now. He's doing just fine, but he has no issue pulling up for 3 and missing wildly in front of tons of people. But there's something unique, and I never played, so I had to listen, and I think that's important. Parents, family members, supporters, if you've never played, you do not know that there was nothing more embarrassing for him than feeling like he was letting his team down by striking out at the plate. And I'm learning that an athlete's best superpower is from the neck up. And so a note to youth sports, family supporters, and athletes, We want to breed confidence, not bleed confidence. And sometimes we bleed confidence that our kids are going to need as adults by the time they're 12.
That's, Lawrence, I'm so grateful you said that, because I think that's a huge, huge piece of this. And it's one of the things that has significantly improved over the past couple of years. The most elite athletes undergo mental training. And I'm imagining how many parents don't get to have that opportunity you had, and what it might look like if, instead of investing in specialized skills training at age 10, you invested in a sports psychologist, and like what a shift that would be. But then again, that would be about preparation, not output.
I'm also thinking like about how young our children, like that were around, begin to specialize. We have seen, especially in recent years, repetitive injuries. I am hyper aware of it as my son is into soccer and he practices 3 times a week. Then there's a game. And if you want to keep up with everybody and improve at the same rate as everyone else, then you have to have a special coach on the side you might meet with once a week. He's in an independent school. The rigor is going to start to increase. You're spending more time on your schoolwork. I think the commitment that you're supposed to put into your sport that you play also is supposed to increase with similar rigor. And he's already exhausted. He still finds it fun. He still wants to play. And it's really like this tension all of the time. And I know I'm not the only parent who feels it, but so I have to say to myself, you know, actually, you don't, at 10, you don't have to be playing 5 or 6 times a week. It's not necessary. I think, I'm seeing a lot of kids play 6, 7 days a week. I ain't even gonna lie, that are on his team, that are in his club, and it's expected. It's like them taking it seriously. And I just put that in air quotes for y'all that aren't watching on YouTube. I'm wondering, has anyone found a balance? This is sports specific. Should our kids be, you know, 3-season athletes? I was on varsity lacrosse. I was on varsity basketball, even though I hated it. And I was on varsity soccer.
Well, I think that there is an important conversation, and this is culturally, and I think generationally. Sometimes our kids aren't good enough, and we delay it. We delay it at all costs. It's not that our children aren't beloved. It's not that our children aren't gifted. It's not that our children are not good people. But there's something about Western entitlement. There's something about American culture that says you can have whatever you want. Sports is such a necessary arena because you can't have what you want. You get what you earn. And I think that sports is disruptive in the youth arena for parents who want to delay the inevitable a little while longer. Because there are going to be colleges that you can't get into. There are going to be jobs that you can't have. There are going to be places you can't go. And at an age where we may want our children to feel like they are the bee's knees and colder than polar bear's toes, you may just not be good enough. This participation versus achievement culture hits an intersection between middle school and high school sports. I am terrible at several sports. By the time I got to high school, I played in what I was good at. And I think in this current moment, working with our children so that they can participate and be healthy in a time when many are not, so that they can be whole and sane in a time when they are not, is valid. And there are some shells that are beyond our children's reach. And I wouldn't want my children to skip an important lesson between learning the difference between entitlement and achievement. And I think for a lot of folks, it's pushing up the date on a conversation they've been delaying.
But I think like specializing so early doesn't give children the opportunity to figure it out, to figure out the love by the time they get to high school. Because if I've only been playing a sport and I'm 14, I haven't had enough of an appetite for anything else because I'm practicing 5 or 6 times a week. You know what I'm saying? So I feel like we're doing a disservice to specialize so early and not giving our kids a chance. I wouldn't advise my kid to marry the first person they dated. I'd be like, absolutely not. We ain't doing this. No, we are not.
I would say, here's what I would add to that, and it's twofold. How many art summer camps did your kids go to? And how many sports summer camps did your kids go to? So we've become so heavily focused on sports, right, that we are not creating a culture where they develop as whole people, right? I think it's why we see, particularly in young male athletes, but we're seeing it in females too, when they sit down, they pick up a remote. Because they're going to play a video game because that's how they know how to relax, because they need to get away from the real world. How many of them would pick up a book? Because all those old tropes about athletes hold true, right? And when you're specializing, and specializing is defined by more than 8 months of the same sport a year, the 412. And so not only are you limiting their short-term ability to develop multiple interests or understand different things. But as an adult, I think this is what so many parents struggle with, is that these parents who didn't have hobbies outside sports don't know how to create space for their children to develop interests and hobbies outside sports. And the number of like athletic parents, I'll be like, I'm going to go to the theater. Like, can I take your kid? Or anything like that. And the answer is like, oh, you know, but I really do think it's because the parents didn't have the chance to develop some of that. Last thing I want to say, the National Athletic Trainers Association put out a statement on this in 2019. And I think it's really valuable for people to look at that there should be rest and recovery, a time away from organized sports, that you should only be on one team at a time. And I think that's part of specialization, is saying, well, but this is your primary sport, so you're going to keep playing this. If you want to do this other thing, you can. But I want to name something that's called long-term athletic development. And the National Sports Medicine Institute talks about this. They have a program around this. And they say the key components of this is physical literacy, which is a broad range of fundamental movements, so that we don't see that overuse and we see foundations for athletic success and doing more than expected, because people who are training one way don't have those levels of movement. Periodization, so structured training and competition across the year to optimize performance while minimizing risk and burnout. Age-appropriate training, like, should a 10-year-old be lifting weights? Question.
No. Period. The end. Go ahead.
And when they talk about age-appropriate training, they're talking also about psychological growth, not just physical growth. And then everyone keeps talking about rest and recovery. But I know so few young people that have a day when they're not doing sports, if they are athletes. Of course, we know the opposite side of that is if they don't have access to athletics, they don't get the 60 minutes a day. Right. And the last thing is multi-sport participation. Over 46% of athletes in the NCAA Division I were multi-sport athletes. And I think that that's, number one, not all of them are going to be in college playing sports. And the number of them that will gain significant college debt by going to a Division III school to play sports because they can't get a scholarship, but sports are more important than anything. Like, that's just... What if you could get a scholarship somewhere else, but you don't play a sport? So yeah, that's my final takes.
All right. No, I appreciate that. I think my final take is that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we were outside playing in our neighborhoods a lot more than children do now. And I think that organized sports has replaced that free play that used to happen after school and on the weekends in our neighborhoods. And as a former PE teacher, I want to stress that organized sports and free play are not the same thing. PE and free play are not the same thing. I'm going to say it louder for the people in the back. Free play and organized anything are not the same. And it breaks my heart. It really does. Because, you know, I used to play street hockey in my neighborhood. I used to play football with boys in my neighborhood. I used to ride bikes everywhere. to the next town, to the next two towns over. Don't tell my parents. But, you know, like, I feel like it has replaced that. And I just want parents to know that they are not the same thing. You don't get the same amount of skills for rewards from free play as you do organized sports. And I think to your point, Jenny, when our kids specialize so early, that sport becomes such a large part of their identity. And when they don't have it anymore, either because they're just not good enough or, you know, injury or, you know, they're no longer interested, then they're in like almost like a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Because what else are they supposed to do for 20 or 30 hours a week now? Like, what's their hobby? What are their interests? I know it's hard because of peer pressure, et cetera. Parents, if you can, introduce other sports to your kids. Don't specialize too young. Take it from the three of us. That's my final take.
Yeah. Let's get access to as many folks as we can.
Amen to that. In the show notes, I'm going to try to put some organizations that exist to give kids access to sports that ordinarily wouldn't have the opportunity to do so. And I am so excited to tell our audience about our upcoming episode that will be a Q&A episode. So y'all, the Third Rail family, will be able to submit your questions to us that you would like us to answer on air. And you have two options to submit those questions. The first option is via email, and these will be in the show notes as well, these instructions. So don't worry if you don't have a pen and paper with you now. But the first is via email. Please send all submissions to questions, that's plural, questions at phillipscollaborative.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Please call 641-715-3900. And our voice box is 138-513-pound. I'll say that one more time. 641-715-3900. And our voicemail box number is 138-513-pound. We cannot wait to hear your questions. All things education, sports, culture, politics, DEI. We're excited.
All right. That's all I had for today, folks. Another hot take on the Third Rail.